Welcome to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the show, made possible by our friends at Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Today, we're in the company of the world's preeminent surf filmmaker. Jack McCoy is a master storyteller and the father of a remarkable body of work that spans multiple eras and includes some of the most significant moments in the history of the sport. American-born, Australian living, McCoy has spent the last 50 years compiling one of the largest and most valuable libraries in surfing history and has worked with its biggest names. One of them is a former guest on this show, the Aussie world champ Mark Occhialupo, who has this month joined McCoy on a touring of their 1999 film, The Occumentary. Jack McCoy, a big welcome to you, and it's a great pleasure to have you on.
Well, as we say in Hawaii, aloha.
It is funny what the mind pictures and envisages. Now, we're speaking over Zoom, but I had pictured you kicking back, feet up, on a hammock, the AirPods in, some sort of green smoothie in the other hand, and I'm not too far off it, am I? Your feet up on the desk instead. Yeah, that's right. You paint a good picture for us.
Funny you say that, because I do live a bit of the life of Riley at the moment. I live up here on the mid-north coast, and I'm on 40 acres. I had a lung disease diagnosed about 8 years ago, which stopped me surfing. So I've returned to the bush. I still go to the beach and, you know, I can paddle and I can go out in little tiny days, but my surf or big wave days are over. But the thing that is so special here is that I'm surrounded by nature. I'm in a national park, border national park, and I just get up every morning, have my cup of coffee and listen and talk to the birds.
So it is fair to say then, isn't it, Jack, that the man who has documented and told the stories of the world's best surfers for 50 years, you're as laid back as the stars of your work?
Well, I try to be. I have a father who was part American Indian, and he's given me some great advice as I grew up. And one of the proverbs that he taught me was the American Indians have something to do, someone to love, and something to look forward to. And that's pretty much all I'm trying to do. Something to do. I've been working on books and little clips and movies and going on tour and all these sort of things that allow me to do great things. I have a beautiful family, gorgeous wife, two kids, three grandchildren, in-law son and an in-law daughter-in-law, and there's where the love goes. And there's something to look forward to every day I get up. You know, as we often don't realize, we breathe in and out about 18 to 25 times a minute. And if you added that up, you breathe 24,000 times in a day. And if you live to be about 75, you're going to do about 800 million breaths. And often we don't take those breaths for how special they are. We take it for granted. We just do it over and over all day, every day, until you can't get one. And so I get up every morning and I give thanks and praises for every breath, because I'm living in such a great place and have such a wonderful life.
They are great things. They are great things to live. Well, it is. It is indeed. Now, you mentioned touring. You're doing that at the moment. So how time flies. So this year actually marks the 25th anniversary of that 99 film, of course, the Occumentary. And you're marking the occasion with a tour, I think, down the east coast of Australia this month with your mate Occy. So aside, I think, from its unveiling back in 99, would this basically be the only time that it would have been shown in cinemas, Jack?
Yes, it is. You know, when it first came out in 99, it was a VHS video.
I remember DVD, those.
So we released the film, but it never got a theatrical screening. You know, I started by showing surfing movies in town halls and some theaters and things, and it was always good to see it on the big screen, but the Occumentary never got a Guernsey. And when I realized early this year that it was 25 years since the Occumentary came out, I told my new son-in-law, hey, we should do something really unique with it. So I went in and I went back into the master files and I blew the film up. When I say that, it was a 4x3 picture, which was television. You blow it up to widescreen today, what we have, which is called 16x9. 49, you lose about 25% of the pictures. So I had to go through every shot, of which there's over 1,000, and computer could tell when the shot started and finished, but I had to move the shot up or down to keep the action in the frame, but lose 25%. And what's happened is that when you finish doing that, the movie looks like it's been shot through a different lens. It's much tighter. It's much more in your face. And when I went down to Sydney a couple of weeks ago to look at the test of the film, I was blown away. It was like a whole new movie. It's in your face. It's bigger. It's more exciting. We also went to the expense and trouble to do a remix of the film into 5.1 stereo. We're playing in theaters. We're not playing in town halls. We're showing it in theaters where the whole experience, the Foo Fighters are going to knock your socks off when you hear them come on. You know, it's going to be a real experience. And so for me, this is an opportunity for me every night, all 10 nights, I'm going to be in the theater in the third or fourth row. I might move around a couple of other times, but I'm going to be right there every night just watching my movie, soaking it up, because, you know, you don't get to watch it in the theater that often.
Before I get you to direct people on where to go if they want tickets, I mean, if people are coming to see something in 4K Ultra HD, it sounds like they're going to be disappointed. Like, this is film.
You know, I've spent my life avoiding video and high def. I'm not personally a big fan of the TV news high definition look. You know, I made my last feature film called A Deeper Shade of Blue, and I did finally shoot it in HD, but I made the pictures softer. You see, video has two fields, and they're come together to make those super sharp images. Well, in post-production, I drop one of the fields. I'm trying to make the picture look softer and more film-like. And so, yes, you are going to see grain. You're going to see flicker. That's the difference between film and video. Video has no flicker, where film, all this film that I've shot, took individual pictures that are strung together, and when they run at normal speed, but they look like film.
But I reckon you would say that means it's got life to it, yeah? Character.
It's a look, you know. The best way to describe it is it's a look. Film has its look. Video has its look. Simple as that, really.
What I love, so Mark Occhialupo, surfing legend, of course, and a great story given he was a child prodigy whose career was derailed by depression, addiction, then the incredible happy ending, that the title, of course, in the twilight of his career. And in this regard, I guess we're speaking at a perfect time, Jack, because your journeys, they're pretty strongly intertwined, aren't they? When you think back to, you know, the Billabong marketing videos of the early 90s, they might have been your defining moment, and they turned out to be his as well, because you got the great man off the couch, and what did he lose? Was it actually 34 kilos to get him back in action?
It was a lot of weight. I'm not sure exact number. Basically, what happened was we did the movie called The Green Iguana, and we did a shoot in the Northwest, and I'd been filming him for a whole year. At the time, through that whole year's filming, he had these really long dreadlocks, and then he turns up for this last shoot in the Northwest, and he's got his hair short. He's cut his hair, and I go, Aki, you've ruined me, you know, what are you doing? My continuity, it's all screwed up now. I made a little sequence using that footage of him with short hair, and I called it Aki's brother, Rocky. And so Aki and Rocky have this little part in that film. Now, it was after that film that he went to Europe to go on the tour, and he did have a bit of a break. And after that, he came back to Australia. He spent 3 years on the couch. His sponsor, gentleman who loved him and was like a father to him, Gordon Merchant, who owned Billabong, looked after him that whole time. And Gordon and I worked on the marketing of the company for many years together. And he just said to me one time, he said, we got to get Aki back. I'm paying him. Let's see if he's got some life left in him. So he sent him over to me in Western Australia. And he moved in with me and my family. And we had a, you know, couple of months there where we just put him on a training program, good food. And he lost all this weight. But his surfing, even though he was big, was unbelievable. He actually was throwing the board and throwing more buckets with water because he had the weight to do it. But he trimmed down. He went back home to the Gold Coast. And the first event that he went in was called the Skin. And it was a specialty event at Bell's Beach. And it's actually a sequence in the movie where he surfs on his back end unbelievably that even today, 25 years later, they're still claiming, you know, that's the best backside surfing anyone's ever done, even including today's surf. We also started a thing called the Billabong Challenge, which enabled us to bring in 8 of the world's best surfers, have an event where we just waited for good waves. See, up until then, pro surfing only had like a final of a contest at the city beach at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, regardless of surf condition. That's the way they ran the surf contest so they could get some media exposure. Gordon and I felt that was really silly. He was spending all this money on these events and surfers, you know, groveling in crummy way. So we said, we're going to go somewhere. We're going to wait for 2 weeks. We're going to have 4 surfers in 2 heats. We're going to be able to run the whole event in 3 hours. So the tide will be very fair to everybody. 2 surfers would advance and would have a 4-man final. And that became the Billabong Challenge. And Aki was able to surf against Kelly Slater, Shane Powell, Rob Machado, and Shane Powell, as well as 4 other surfers, Johnny Boy Gomes, Margo, and Luke Egan. So the Billabong Challenge really gave Aki the confidence to go back on tour. And the first year he came back, he came 2nd on the world tour to Kelly Slater. And he'd tell me if that wasn't a boost of confidence, you know? Yeah. And so Aki then, you know, went on the tour again, did another year. And in that year, he became world champion at the end of the day. That's the story.
Amazing story it is too. You're listening to This Is Your Journey. It's all thanks to Tobin Brothers, a family-owned business since 1934. So a curious mind fosters a deep-seated passion. We'll retrace Jack McCoy's formative steps to filmmaking after this.
You're listening to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. You're listening to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Company on This Is Your Journey, made possible by Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. We're with legendary surf filmmaker Jack McCoy. So, Jack, you're born in Los Angeles as the son of a radio and TV show host. Do you remember much of your early days in California?
A little bit. We lived in the Valley. My father worked in Hollywood. He had a television show called Glamour Girl. And it's where he and his partner would have 3 women come out and tell their story about why they want to be a glamour girl. And then they'd have like a hoot meter at the end where the audience would clap. And whoever got the most claps became the glamour girl. They would take her the next day in a limo, get her hair done, buff her out, do her hair, give her a mink coat. And then they'd bring her back the next day and reveal her in front of a mirror. And that's sort of the show that he did. And he did that for 5 years, which was very successful. But he got sick of living there in Los Angeles, and he wanted to take his family, his young family, to Hawaii, where he'd been during the war. He'd gone through Hawaii, thought it was beautiful, so he just packed us up and off we went. And then he started the only live television show in Hawaii. Up until then, all the programs were brought in, and it was like a variety show. It was called The Jack McCoy Show, of course. He interviewed everyone from Elvis Presley down. Whoever came to Hawaii was on his show. They eventually moved it to a shopping center where every Saturday morning it was broadcast live in Hawaii. And that went for 12 years. And he then went on to become a radio and radio personality as well.
I'd imagine, though, that before you can form the idea of wanting to photograph, as you did early on, and film surfing, you've got to fall in love with surfing in the first place. So how did that love for the water come about as a kid for you, Jack?
My dad pushed me on my first wave when I was about 8 years old. And like the Beach Boys said, catch a wave and you're sitting on top of the world. And that's the feeling that I had as I'm gliding on this wave and going in. I turned around to look back where it came from, where my dad pushed me, and I traveled all that distance, and it just captured my imagination. And then we moved to the other side of the island. We moved a block from the beach. The beach was where I hung out. It was where I wanted to be. Back then, I was just body surfing, and we had these things called pipo boards, which are just basically a piece of plywood, and you'd lay down like a boogie board on your... And then I saved up $120 for my first surfboard, and that was it.
So I guess as kids or teens, you know, we're looking for a spark, aren't we? We don't know it necessarily, but we're looking for a direction, I guess, a path to follow. So Roosevelt Auditorium, 1967. This is the Hawaiian premiere of the surfing film Free and Easy. Now, you're there, and so is a man by the name of Jim Freeman. How important, looking back, was Jim in your journey, Jack?
I went and saw my first surfing movie, which was a Bruce Brown film, when I was about 13. My dad took me to the show, and this guy he sold you the tickets. He got up, introduced the show, then he ran to the back of the auditorium and turned the lights off, started the projector, ran up the front, sat behind a little coffee table with a reel-to-reel tape recorder and played the music and narrated the movie. And he did that, you know, for the first half, did the same thing for the second half. And it blew my mind. And I went home that night thinking, God, that guy is so cool. And what he's doing looks like so much fun. And I believe that's really where that started. Now, what happened was that I got to know Bruce. And when he came back to Hawaii the next year, he sent me the poster. And I became what was known as a poster Grimmie. And I would go around to the bakery or to the stores and put up the posters around our town. And then Free and Easy came along, and I got to meet Jim Freeman. And Jim Freeman was the guy who kind of took me under his wing with Free and Easy, and he and I became really good friends along with his partner, Greg. And they went on to make iconic surf movies, Waves of Change, Sunshine Sea, and Five Summer Story. They then went on to become the kings of IMAX. To this day, Greg has produced over 30 IMAX. His partner, Jim, was killed in a helicopter crash in 1970. I dedicated my first film to him for the influence that he had on me as a friend and also as a man. But yeah, that was a real turning point in my life, meeting not only Bruce, but Jim and Greg.
So a dozen years later or thereabouts, you find yourself on a plane to Australia. So what took you to this country in 1970, Jack? I'm curious.
I came here as part of the Hawaiian surf team for the world contest that was held at Bells Beach. I'd had a bout of hepatitis where I didn't surf for about 6 months. And when I had a board sitting in my room, and I looked at it the whole time. And when I was given permission to go surf, I went to a Makaha contest. I wasn't really much of a competitor, but I went to it. And I got sixth, which enabled me to be like the 13th man of a 12-man team. I was the backup. But I'd only competed in one event. That's why I had no other results, so to speak. But I had enough result from that to become part of the team. I came here, did a trip from Victoria all the way to Noosa. And everywhere we went, we followed a big south swell up the coast. It was like, oh my God, here we go again. Another spot today. We went to Foresters in the Central Coast. We went to Crescent. We went to, you know, Angarie and Lenox and finally end up at Noosa. And as we're traveling, every night we would go to the pub after a surf. And all I had to do was open my mouth. And God, I had several new girlfriends that were quite happy to have me keep talking to them. So as a young, dumb little Hawaiian kid, this was like, oh my God, this place is unreal. And so I had a 30-day ticket, and then I just said, I'm packing that in. And so I stayed an extra 6 months. I went back to Hawaii. My girlfriend had married one of my best friends despite me. So I got back on the plane, came straight back to here, and Greg McGilvery and Jim Freeman gave me a job showing surfing films. Well, there's films here.
That'll do it. That'll get you back here pretty quick sticks, I reckon. That doesn't sound great.
Hey, that's the story of McCoy, Australia being stuck with me.
Yeah. But somewhere around this time, Jack, I know you were going around showing movies, as you say, but you got into the, and I find this part of your story to be one that stands out a bit from the rest of it. You got into the restaurant game here in Melbourne. Now, what was that about? Was the idea, I can surf all day here and sling a few meals of an evening? Or what was the thinking there?
That's it. You're exactly right. You see, one of my heroes was a guy named Joey Cabell, and he was not only a great surfer, but a great skier. And he and a few friends opened a restaurant in Aspen called the Chart House. which was a steak and seafood sort of restaurant. Then they went to Newport Beach and started one, and they did one in Hawaii. And he, you know, was able to set up this sort of empire where he did, you know, go in, do a few things at night, and then he'd go surf all day. And for some reason, I had it in my head that that would be a good idea for me to do. So two Kiwi guys and I also wanted to live in an environment that was cold. I said, hey, I want to go see what it's actually like to surf and do this. Plus, it was where Wayne Lynch was living, and I was fascinated with his surfing. I figured if I could get to Victoria, I'd be able to see him surf more. So we started this restaurant, went to buy a whole bunch of old furniture. We fixed it up. We built the kitchen. And then once we opened, we found that we would get up in the morning about 6, go to Geelong, do the shopping, come back, prepare all the food. 4 o'clock, we'd race home, take a shower, come back, you know, and sit there and serve meals and then wait till midnight to everybody to leave. You know, we did 2 years of that until I realized that's not really me, you know. But so we were going to move up to Queensland, where instead of just a 4 month season, we could have more of a round, you know, round seasonal clientele. In that little process, in that gap there, I went skiing and I got hit on the head. Got KO'd pretty badly. I was unconscious for a few days. And when I woke up, it was all a little bit confused to me. And a guy who I'd been showing my surfing films with, Dick Hoole, who I'd met in Hawaii, came along and put a camera in my hand and said, we're going to go make a movie. And I said, we can't make a movie. We don't know what we're doing. And he said, yeah, we know what the people want. We'll go shoot it. So that's what we did. Like two naive grommets, we went out there and made every mistake we could and made our first surfing film called Tubular Swells. It was released in 1976.
Just before I get to Tubular Swells in more detail, the accident, how bad was the amnesia? Did you lose your memory for a long period of time, a short period of time? All of your memory, some of your memory? How bad was it?
At the start, it was very confusing. I didn't really know what a lot of things were. And then slowly, it was like a bookshelf falling over and you slowly put the books back in play. One of the big things for me, though, was that I didn't know if I was remembering things, remembering what I was being told. Do you remember this or do you remember that? Tell me about it. And they'd tell me and I would take that on. I did for a while there. It was kind of serious.
Pretty scary stuff.
And when I went to Bali a few months later, Jerry Lopez goes, you lost your memory. Show me the place where you get hit. I want to go get it hit. He says, where's the spot?
Yeah, where's the erase button? Just with Tubular Swells, I think you might have said this way back when, but looking back, was this a film that sucked you into your life's work? Like, I mean, I imagine the budget would have been minuscule. It can't have been big, Jack. And you were, as you say, fumbling your way around to some degree with Dick Hoole, who was another big influence in your journey. Was it what really set the scene for the rest of your life, the first of many in many ways?
It was. You know, I really felt this was an opportunity for me to be able to spend the rest of my life at the beach. You know, and I got the same feeling that I got from the Bruce Brown movie when I went and showed my movie, that I was sharing the stove with the tribe. Up until then, there was no internet. Surf magazines and surf movies were the only way surfers were able to, you know, see what was going on. And so I'd be like the most popular guy in town when I'd turn up with the movie. And the people were just so enthralled and appreciative. You know, I met so many great people in my travels. And I could see after we did our first run and we'd actually put some money in our pocket that this is something good for me.
You mentioned the magazine, sorry. Like, you and Dick were reporters for, I think it was for Trax, wasn't it? The Surfer's Bible. Like, you would take photos on the black and white film because, well, I imagine color was too expensive.
Well, yeah, we started as cub reporters for Trax. Trax came out in 1971. I had a camera and Dick had a camera, and we would shoot black and white because we could buy it in bulk. We would load our own cartridges. We would process our own film, and we would make prints. And that, I believe, gave me a very solid, you know, education about composition and dimension, framing, and all kinds of things that I carried on into my film work. But yeah, Trax was a newsprint publication didn't have any colors, so mostly we did shoot black and white. We did also go on to make a magazine. You see, Albie Felsen made Morning of the Earth, but he had a magazine to promote it. So when we made our first Nerf movie, Doug Warbrick and Brian Singer, who owned Rip Curl, and I, age reporter named Michael Gordon, and Dick Hull and I started a magazine called Backdoor that we ran out of Torquay, and we did 18 issues, which was about 18 months before that proved a bit too hard. Surf industry wasn't known for paying their bills that much, so it was hard to run, you know, keep the magazine going. But we also decided that we didn't need to use the magazine to promote our films. We needed to just make the films. So
yeah,
for the next 4 years, we showed other people's movies for them from America. We had a contract at the Opera House, and so every summer we used that to show films. That was a really great cash register there for us for a while. And then in 1980, we decided we were going to make a second feature film. And with the help of Rip Curl, we were able to do that and released in 1982.
We're with world-renowned and award-winning surf filmmaker Jack McCoy on This Is Your Journey. It's thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. There's plenty more ahead of us, so stick around.
You're listening to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. You're listening to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hello, we hope you're enjoying this week's edition of This Is Your Journey. Today's guest is a legend of surfing cinematography. We're with Jack McCoy. So Jack, as we said before, you actually get a movie camera in your hands and you put Tubular Swells together with Dick Hull. How did you actually seek to capture the sport you love so much? Like shooting in the water, what went into it? How much was it about almost, you know, walking for the first time, trial and error, what works, what doesn't? What actually went into practically and literally shooting a surfing movie?
Whew, that's a big broad brushstroke.
Well, did you know what you had to do from the start? Or I guess what level of detail did you have before you went into it? Did you have preconceived ideas as to what was going to work and what didn't? Or was it a total blank canvas?
Yeah, it was sort of a blank canvas. However, we had other friends who were surf movie makers, and we saw what they did. You knew you had to turn up at the beach. You knew there was long hours standing there behind the camera. I read everything I could about filmmaking and photography. I knew that I didn't want to shoot from one angle for too long. I knew I wanted to keep mixing up my angles. My big passion, though, was shooting from the water. That was a process that required quite a bit of trial and error. One of the big things was water drops in front of your lens. Back then, you used to get a couple of drops and it'd ruin your shot. So I had to figure out best way to do that, which was a closely guarded secret for many years. Every guy who wanted to be a surf movie guy would always contact me and say, "You know, I keep the water off my port." I'd say, "Oh, if I told you, I'd have to kill you."
Technology-wise here, we're talking about the camera. Was it a 16 mil Bolex, like an absolute collector's item now? Is that what you were working with?
Well, it's what all the other surf movie guys use. And so we figured if Bruce Brown made his Endless Summer with the Bolex, you know, that's what we had to have. And
yeah,
that's what we bought. The thing with the Bolex was that it didn't have an electric motor. It had a spring, and you had to wind up the spring like an alarm clock. You press the button, and that spring would expand to the point where it would get to the end, and it would stop. And you would have to rewind the camera. Now, if you look at the Endless Summer, the original one, he's filming Cape St. Francis, explains to you that his camera runs out of wine because the wave's too long. So he picks up the wave again, you know, makes a deal out of it. Well, for us, it was, you know, the same thing. But 18 seconds, which was about the average length you could shoot before you had to wind it up again, was enough to capture quite a shot. So that's the camera that I used right up until 2002 to shoot my 16 mil. And the reason was, is I did try electric cameras, but you'd be out in the field somewhere and the camera wouldn't work and it's electrical and I didn't know how to fix it there. I'd have to take it back and I'd miss something. So I just went, go with it. It's like a Swiss watch, you know. It was just, you could drop it, you could bounce it off the ground, you could do whatever you get. It was just a real workhorse.
And one part about the Bolex did surprise me though. You know, I'm thinking you're making tubular swells in the mid-70s. How are you getting in the water? But the underwater housing exists, well, I think came about in the mid-50s, which surprised me. Does that ring true to you? Certainly for a long time prior to you getting into filmmaking.
This particular housing I had was made by a company at the time who specialized in water housing, but it was called a splash housing. What I mean by splash, it wasn't meant for diving because it was just a round piece of plexiglass with a back on it and a front that would come off. You put the front port on, screw it up with wing nut, and it would go in the front there. But what you were doing was actually swimming with like a beach ball. This thing didn't like to go into tens of waves. So,
it sounds like a workout, you
know, too. Oh, it was a workout, but it was also pretty funky for its day. But it got us some great shots once you figured out how to use it. I can recall a couple of times being caught inside a pipeline. What happens at pipeline is you shoot the first wave, and then the current takes you into actual impact zone of where the wave is. And a couple of times I got caught in there with this beach ball and I'm trying to get it underwater and it's not going, it's not getting me deep enough. Boy, did I take some punishment.
I'm glad you mentioned, getting deep enough though. So tubular swell stands at the head of a four-decade run of filming. Like it goes on, there's Storm Riders, Kong's Island, the documentary mentioned Blue Horizon, A Deeper Shade of Blue and A Stack More. I just wanted to ask you about A Deeper Shade of Blue because I believe that movie lives on in many ways. Most notably because you used, I don't even know what you'd call it, maybe an underwater jet ski, which at the time, I don't know how many people did that, Jack. I mean, to get shots behind the wave, and there is some spectacular sequences in that film as a result.
One of the big things about shooting in the water for me was that I would swim out sometimes and have a mask, an underwater mask or goggle, and I could see what was happening behind the wave. And it was another show altogether. It was happening on every wave. The show back there was amazing. And so when I had this other camera, I would go down and I would have to wait for something to go by me and I would shoot it. As time went on, I got a high-speed camera, which allowed me to shoot 200 frames in a second, which is 8 times slower than normal. So it slowed it right down. And this one was a sinker. This thing was like a brick, 12, 15 kilo. And it would allow me to sit there on the bottom and again, wait for everything. And I dreamed of being able to track underwater. A friend of mine and I tried a thing after we'd done a Disney feature. I hooked up with a gentleman named Simon Christides, and we tied a couple of those little four-knot little putt-putt underwater scooters together to try and get enough power, but just wouldn't push the camera. And then I was on location for A Deeper Shade of Blue with first shoot, and a friend of mine, Todd Bennett, introduced me to what was called a sea bob. And this was all battery, 150-pound battery, but it had an electric motor that allowed you to do 14 knots underwater. You could actually move around underwater. So I went back to the boat, I strapped this thing roughly to it, and I found out that this was the dream I'd been waiting for, a dream come true. And Todd eventually sold me one of his. I brought it back to Australia. I made a special customized carbon fiber mount that slid over the front of the underwater ski. It had a little platform to strap the camera to, but also had a cinch knob that allowed me to go up or down or swing it from side to side. So I could get all kinds of different angles. And this allowed me not to follow at the same speed as a surfer, but it allowed me to track underwater. Getting caught inside or getting caught by a wave with this 150-pound piece of battery could have crushed me, could have killed me. So I went to Tahiti 5 times and just slowly worked my way up, getting closer and closer. Now, to get the best shots, I found I had to have a wide-angle lens. So in some cases, or most cases, I'm filming probably about 6 feet away from the extremely dangerous sort of work. When I did finally get a really great day, I did this particular, had a great day, and I came back to my friend's house and I strung up all the shots. There was 30 minutes of footage from that. And like I do most of the time, I like to put a song to the images to give me a feel for how it's going. And I was listening at the time to an album called The Fireman, and it's a album by Paul McCartney and another guy named Martin Glover called The Fireman. It worked really well. And so I came back to Australia and I said to my producer, hey, can we try and get this song for our movie? She says, oh, I don't know. It's Paul Paul McCartney, let me see. And about a month later, she comes and goes, oh, we got the clip. We got permission to use Paul Singh. I was so stoked. And then a couple of months later, a music friend of mine, Chris Thomas, comes to Australia. And I met him during the In Excess days. He produced Kick and what was it? Listen Like Thieves and Kick. I showed him. I said, hey, Chris, this is a new underwater thing. He goes, what's the music? I go, it's your buddy, Paul McCartney. Chris started his career with George Martin as an assistant on the White Album. And the next album Chris Thomas produced was Dark Side of the Moon. So this guy had some runs on them. And he also produced a couple of tracks for Paul. So he said, give me a copy of the clip. Let me go show it to Paul. About 6 months after that, I get a message from Chris saying, Paul loved the clip that you did with the Fireman so much so that he wants to do something else with you. He's got a new song. So make a long story short, that's how I met Paul McCartney, made him a clip, and we've become friends ever since.
I love it. Sliding, wasn't it? A video clip?
I've made 5 clips. For him. I made Blue Sway. I made a thing on Ocean's Kingdom, which is a ballet that he did. I made him a music video for a song called Wine Dark Open Sea. And then after lockdown, he did an album and he called me up and said, hey, I got this track. It's called Sliding. It seems like it needs some extreme footage. Can you help me out? So I heard this song and I went, oh, and I thought of Craig Anderson, Newcastle surfer, one of my favorite surfers. And I got him to give me the name of some of his friends who had some footage, and I put the clip together for Paul, and it became the official video, the release of that song. And then when Paul, 8 months later, he did kind of a collaboration with all different artists of all the songs on that McCartney 3 album with cover. And Ed O'Brien did the Sliding version. And Ed said to Paul, hey, can I have a surf clip just like yours? He goes, yeah, let me check with Jack. And so I met a guy named Ty Glang. He had this incredible footage. So to make a long story short, for Sliding, we made 2 different videos that became official videos for the track.
You're listening to This Is Your Journey. It's thanks to Tobin Brothers Funeral Celebrating Lives. We'll be back with surfing filmmaker Jack McCoy after this break.
You're listening to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. You're listening to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
It's been great to have your company here on This Is Your Journey. Thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. We've been joined today by revered and award-winning surfing filmmaker Jack McCoy. Jack, just all the techniques in the water and under the water and all that sort of stuff, but how conscious were you of also telling the stories out of the water, the people, the cultures, or more accurately, I guess the essence of surfing as a lifestyle and a way of life, as opposed to, you know, some guys with big kahunas catching monster waves?
You know, I've always been a bit of a storyteller. We tried with our first 2 movies, Tubular Swells and Storm Riders, we followed pretty much the same formula as all the other filmmakers before us. You know, we're going here now to Hawaii, and we're seeing Joe, and then we went to Mexico, and you know, it was this formula that everybody used. In the mid-80s, after Storm Riders, I'd go to big Australian industry events and, you know, people would say, oh, what do you do, Jack? I go, oh, I make movies. Oh, yeah, what sort of? Oh, I make documentary. Oh, that's so cool. What sort of documentary? I go, surf movie. And they'd look at me and go, oh. And they'd walk away. You know, as a surf filmmaker, I wasn't recognized as a filmmaker. And then a couple of years later, I went to Hollywood, where I lived with a friend who had a celebrity bed and breakfast. And the owner of the place and I made a film that didn't have any talking. It was just what we called all rockin' and no talk. But it told stories through the music. We let the music be the form of the storytelling. And this was a clip that, you know, I'd just come back from the jungles of Java, and the owner's wife would say, hey, Eric, like Eric Idle was staying at the house, take Eric down and show him your surf movies. And he'd look and I'd show him, I'd swim out with the camera and I do this, and we're in the jungle and the tigers and the blah, blah. And he'd go, God, you're a real artist, you know? And so it really gave me a confidence to start to look at a different way to make surfing films. And with the Surf His Little Movie that we made, I came back to Australia and knew that it was time to try and make a different type of film. So I made this series of films for Billabong. One was called Bunyip Dreaming, the other was called The Green Iguana, and the other was called Sons of Fun and Sick Joy. And these films were formed, again, music being the form of storytelling that really gave you a feeling of surfing. And yet, you know, I believe music's 50% of the movie experience. They go hand in hand. And when the music's telling you the story with the emotion and your images, you can pull that storytelling off. And then the next project I started, as I mentioned earlier, was the Billabong Challenge. And so for the first time, I brought along five or six other friends, photographers who worked with me. And the whole objective was to tell story. And then went right through to a film I did of Laird's Wave in Tahiti. That was like a 30-minute TV show, full story. And then the next feature I did was Blue Horizon. And this starred a guy named David Rastovich and Andy Iron. And the idea was to have a free surfer, or a surfer who got paid to go surfing and didn't compete, and a competitor, and checkerboard their lives. And that became one of my most popular films, mainly because what the story unfolded in front of you, you couldn't have scripted if you had to. The whole world title that year that I was filming, Andy, came down to the last contest and the last heat to the last wave with Kelly Slater. And then Andy won. So that was my story. And you know, when Andy won, I just jumped up and down going, yee-hee, I got a movie. Feature was one on Joel Parkinson. That was more of a fun little story. And then there was A Deeper Shade of Blue. And what I wanted to do with that is to talk about where surfing came from and what it was, and surf culture, and also the spirit of aloha, what that actually means, and the evolution of the surfboard. So that was sort of my grand opus, you could say. That was 5 years in the making, and still one of my most prized films in my mind. And I call my movies souvenirs of my life, you know, because I get to sit back and watch them. I sat down and watched the documentary just before I started to do it, and I just went, God, that's not a bad movie. You know, I hadn't seen it in like 15 years or something. And I do that occasionally. I'll pull out one of my old films and just trip out with it. And I remember where I was, what beach I shot, and what music I was listening to. And, you know, like I say, it's just a memory.
Jack, before we let you go, I was going to ask you, for those budding filmmakers out there who might be listening to this, what advice you might have. Am I right to say that when you're in the cut and thrust of filmmaking, that you never actually watched anyone else's films, that such was your desire to not be influenced? Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. Yeah, there were a lot of new up-and-coming filmmakers who are doing things that people are going, oh, you should see what this guy's doing. You should see what that is. I say, no, I just didn't want to. I would hear some some people say, oh, this new guy on the block, he shot some shots just like you did, of running the camera through some flowers or something in slow motion. And you know, they say copying is the greatest form of flattery you can have. I didn't want to have to have anybody say that, oh, I'd use their idea or things. And another one of my things was not to make the same movie twice. I always gave myself different objectives and different things I wanted to try with every film. Wanted to just, you know, come up with something different.
Jack McCoy, thanks so much for joining us today. I mean, for someone who has made a career and built a glowing reputation, I might add, telling other people's stories, yours is just as amazing. So your passion is there for everyone to see and to witness. And the beauty of it all is that it will stand the test of time. It's doing that now. So well done on everything you've achieved. It's certainly a life well lived. And thanks for sharing some of it with us today.
And if you want to see the documentary, please come see it in the theater. Tickets at jackmccoy.com.
Jackmccoy.com. Beautiful. You've been listening to This Is Your Journey for Tobin Brothers Funeral. Celebrating lives. Jump online. You can find them at tobinbrothers.com.au, and we'll catch you the next time we celebrate another great sporting journey.